Today we are continuing the discussion of this very interesting subject, how are we reborn? I think at the very beginning, maybe in the first session, I mentioned that there are certain things in our life that are apparently not verifiable. Using the tools of modern science and technology or modern reasoning. But we know certain things to be real. We may not publicly express them. We may be considered to be a little odd or strange, even sometimes even crazy. But in our life situations, when we encounter certain events in our life, suddenly, it comes as a big revelation. And law of karma and the doctrine of reincarnation or rebirth belong to that category. I already mentioned in my earlier sessions that the entire dynamics of life, birth, death, rebirth, and again, all this becoming part of our evolution. Evolution not the biological or physical level. Evolution at a different level. Evolution at the level of values, understanding, perception, emotional maturity and so on. In this, the connecting link between what we do and what happens later as a result of what we do, that link may not be scientifically explained, but we can strongly feel the reality of them. As I mentioned, every action, not just physical action, any kind of activity, speaking, thinking, doing things, or just even an idea that comes to our mind, all these have two types of consequences. One, something that is tangible. The other, which is not visible, not obvious, but that invisible result influences our future actions and experiences. It's called samskara. Chakram, that's a technical term used in the yoga psychology. Not in the Hatha Yoga physical postures, but the great philosophy and psychology behind yoga, Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Every action produces a residual effect, both visible and invisible, as I mentioned just now. And it becomes a strong, a potent tendency. The tendency you cannot wish away. See, our mind reacts in a certain way, and we know it's not appropriate, but we cannot resist, we can't but act in a certain manner. If we are all computers, and if we can act according to some instruction from another source of intelligence, and we can act exactly as we want, there will be actually no problems in the world. You can imagine that. Everyone wants to live a happy life in this world. Do good things. Happy relationships. Everyone. Most, maybe 99% of the human population wants good things in life. Wants to experience good things in life. Even the hardcore criminals really want something good if there's an option for it. But they can't help it. So it means there is always a gap between what we want, what we sincerely desire, what we may sincerely endeavor for, and what we get. I mean, the wide gap, the distinction, the difference between what we want and what our mind gives us. What we want to do and what our mind allows us to do. So what is that that obstacle that stands between what we want to do and what we end up doing. Samskaras. Samskaras are invisible but strongly felt. Very strongly felt. And urge a direction in which our mind flows, our action is directed, our thoughts move and flow. That is the samskaras. Now, there is a way for us to change our own mental constitution. This may be a total surprise to modern psychology. See, modern psychology, psychiatrists may recommend a medicine, maybe therapy, going to some place, and or, as I mentioned frequently in a lighter vein, a motivational speech, which can either drive you crazy or can give you a momentary feeling of well, everything is okay. But again, mind comes back to where it was earlier. Now, yoga and Vedanta present a different solution, not properly understood or recognized in modern times. That is, by doing something good, you can change your destiny. Doing something good is a general term, not easy to understand. If you ask a person, you should read the Sermon on the Mount, he may buy a book, you may gift him a free book, leave him in his room, but his mind won't permit him to read that, or the Bible, or Bhagavad Gita, or any holy book, Dhammapada, any book that can really help us in our life. His mind won't permit him to read that. You put before him a thriller, a sense kind of sensational book, and his mind is very happy. His mind will tell him, go ahead, read it, no problem. The moment you watch something good, you switch off the TV. On the other hand, you switch on something which may not be very good. What is that invisible stumbling block? The huge accumulated reservoir of negative samskaras, negative tendencies, prevent us from doing what we want to do, even if that's very good. We are prevented from doing what we actually need to do and what we actually want to do. This is samskaras. These samskaras can be modified, can be refined. See, for example, suppose you have milk, very thick milk, and it can create digestion problems. You add water. So the milk quantity, the percentage of the milk is reduced in direct proportion to the increasing percentage of water. Like that, if our negative samskaras are predominant in our mental system, you just generate some positive samskaras. And then what happens, you know, the potency of negative samskaras will be radically reduced. Just like the potency of milk will be reduced if you pour water into it. So positive samskaras will reduce the potency of negative samskaras in creating problems for the mind. And how do we generate these positive samskaras? Reading a book, mind won't allow you. Travel somewhere means go to a holy place, a place where you associate with people that will be helpful for us. We won't be allowed to do that. Our mind will not allow you to do that. But suppose you go to the, let's say, any kind of noble, unselfish physical activity. It may be traveling 40 miles, going to a place, listening to some higher ideas. It may be going to the nearby, place which is neglected, which requires some cleaning up. You participate in that kind of activity, any kind of social activity, or even send a check for $100 to help people suffering from maybe some natural calamities in a distant continent where tsunamis, there are many places where people suffer. They may not even demand, ask for it, but you do that. You find you have generated a small quantity of positive samskaras. How do we recognize that it is really a positive samskaras? There is a miraculous and very effective way of recognizing the effect of positive samskaras coming from positive actions. Oh, I have done something really worthwhile. It is a feeling, your own private feeling in your own private mind. We feel, oh, I had done something worthwhile, something really good. Nobody else knows that you have made a donation of $100 to help somebody in a far distant place. But your mind recognizes that. It's your own private world, you recognize that. In Sanskrit, there are certain interesting terms used. I mentioned this here, kṛta-kṛtyada, kṛtārthada, chāridārthyada, and so on. A feeling, well, this is something that I should have done. So this happens. This is how we generate spiritual energy, positive energy, and that will dilute the huge accumulation of negative tendencies. And to that extent, the negative tendencies become weaker and weaker. And as we go on doing good and noble deeds, thoughts, words, activities, the huge accumulated quantity of positive samskaras will dilute and weaken and eventually neutralize the negative samskaras. And then you go and try to meditate, mind is very happy. Mind will cooperate with you when you try to meditate. Because you have given some good food to the mind, positive food. Good food to the mind will make the mind healthier and stronger. Vigorous, just a physical body. And how does mind tell us you have done something good for me? The mind is happy when you do something that you know to be very good for you. When you try to meditate, when you try to do something good, when you try to stop smoking, when you try to stop taking drugs, when you try to stop doing, say, spending too many hours with internet or maybe undesirable things. It may be very good, of course. Internet is a very wonderful blessing for modern technology. Can be terrible curse also, as we all know. So when our mind flows towards something that's really not good for us, mind itself will tell you it's not good for you. And when you withdraw from that activity, mind will tell you, thank you, don't do that. On the other hand, when negative samskaras are predominant, what happens when you do something that is actually bad for us? Mind will, oh, go ahead, do that. In fact, in the Gita, there are Asuri Sampat and Devi Sampat. These are all technical terms, you know. I mean, divine attributes or spiritual attributes and negative or demonic attributes. These are different Sanskrit terms. Now, I am going to explain this in the light of certain very interesting episodes from our ancient scriptures. The reason why I refer to these ancient scriptures is you can read any of these books in our in books that are already published. I mentioned earlier. See the story of a king. The king, his name is a philosopher king, Parikshit. He was the grandson of Arjuna. The story begins at the beginning of the first book, Skanda, called Bhagavata Purana. In a nutshell, the story is this: a great king who had a great reputation for all his noble qualities, all that he did, his maturity and wisdom. This man one day happened to do something very nasty. He was moving in a forest. He was hungry and thirsty. And he happens to see a small hut, a hermitage. And he enters the hermitage because he wanted to get some drinking water. And he has entered the hermitage. There's a old sage sitting there immersed in meditation. Now, he didn't get up because he didn't know the thirsty king had entered hermitage. So he didn't know. The king, because he was so hungry and thirsty, he lost his balance. And he thought, he's so arrogant that doesn't even greet me. Remember, this king was so well known as a very compassionate king. But sometimes this happens to some very, very noble people. How they respond to those situations later, that's what actually makes the difference. All people face challenging situations, make mistakes. But how we react to our own mistakes when we think over them later, that's what actually draws the dividing line between the ideal men and those who are not so ideal. So the difference is, the king did such a terrible thing. He looked around and he found a dead snake lying outside, and he lifted the snake with his bow and he put it on the neck of this sage. His name was Shamika, and he went away. Later, his son came, and the son came to know that somebody had put this dirty, smelling, stinking, dead snake on his father's neck, and father was still immersed in meditation. He woke him up and told him, see what has happened, and there was a dirty smell all around. They didn't know who had done it, but then his son was also a very, very elevated spiritual seeker, but not fully enlightened. So he had a lot of spiritual pride because he was a big enlightened man. So he put a curse on on the person who had done such a heinous crime, putting a dead snake on the neck of his aged father. And the curse was this: anyone who had done such a terrible thing, he will die by snake bite on the seventh, before the seventh day of, before the seventh day from now. So 7 into 24 hours. That was the lifetime left for the person who had done it. But his father, who was a great sage, he came to know who had done it. And he scolded his son for cursing the king. Of course, they did not know at that time it was the king who had done it. But the sage later came to know it was the king who had, by mistake, had done it. Because he knew this king was a really great man. You can find a lot of references and stories and episodes in ancient Hindu classics. They depict this Parikshit as a great philosopher king. But anyway, the sage scolded his son for cursing the king, though by mistake he did not know it was the king anyway. And then he sent his disciples to the king. See, I'm sorry, the young man, by mistake he had cursed you, and his curse will come true. You are going to die within 7 days. The king came to know. He did not get angry. So he knew he had done something terrible. He repented. And he said, there are long verses in the Bhagavata Purana, first Kanda. He said, I deserve this because I should never have done such a thing. So he could not forgive himself for what he did. So that's the difference between a great man and those who may not be so great. This king, when he came to know of the mistake he had committed, he repented and he considered himself to be deserving of that terrible curse. And what he did, you know, now remember, here is a king who has such a high reputation, but did something absolutely horrendous, and for which he himself was not willing to forgive himself. And what he did, he wanted to do something for his next life. Because he knew that if he didn't do anything, if he did not generate a huge reservoir of positive samskaras and tendencies, he may be born in some very, very terrible conditions. So what he did, he wanted to get some bank balance, spiritual bank balance, which will help him to get rid of the terrible sins he had committed. So he left his kingdom, his palace, all his luxuries, wealth, and he made his own eldest son, according to story, Janamejaya, that's the name of the king, his father, and he was declared as heir apparent. He left his kingdom, went to the banks of the holy river Ganga, sat there in meditation. He knew he had only 7 days to live, 7 into 24 hours. So what was he trying to do? He was trying to generate some wealth for him, spiritual wealth. How can he do that? By meditation, by doing something good. You have to remember, at the very first lecture, I referred to Dostoevsky's Idiot. You have to think of that. Totally different situation. In Dostoevsky's Idiot, the sentenced man knew he'll be shot. The firing squad has assembled. They're ready with the rifles. The scene is set in the mid-19th century Russia. Dostoevsky's Idiot. He knew he had just a few, 5-6 minutes to go. So he thought, well, how am I going to spend my 5-6 minutes? First he said, I shall be a good man. And in the original work, long back when I was a boy, I threw a stone at a dog. I should never have done it. So mentally he apologized to the dog, hypothetically. And then he thought, I shall shake hands with all my other criminals who have assembled. Remember, this was actually a kind of a pseudo event, you know. Actually, the story is taken from Dostoevsky's own life. Himself had undergone the same experience, which he actually imposed upon a character, an imaginary fictitious character in Idiot. Himself was sentenced, and then the firing squad were ready, but King Alexander III, perhaps, Russian, not king, was a czar, you know. One of the very few enlightened kings that Russian history can boast of, Alexander, the great, one of the greatest names in the dynasty of Romanovs. So he wanted to teach these criminals a lesson. So they were sentenced to death, but he also made arrangement. At the last moment, somebody will come and give them a reprieve, clemency. They will be saved. It is commuted to some minor, a few years of Siberia, that's all. But anyway, but the criminals thought they were going to die. And Dostoevsky was saved like that. So that story has put in the character an Idiot. So the criminal is thinking, I have 5-6 minutes more. He's looking at the church, Russian Orthodox Church, with its golden towers and all that. And he thinks the sunrise falling on the golden towers. And then I will go and I will reach the heavens, the celestial regions and so on. Before that, I shall ask for mercy with everyone. I shall shake hands with everyone. I shall be a good person. This is Dostoevsky in mid-19th century, the Idiot. In our story, Bhagavata Purana, which is 2000 years older, the king thought, he had 7 days to live, 7 into 24 hours. So what he did, he left his kingdom, palace, everything, went to the banks of Ganga, sat there in meditation. And a number of great sages assembled on the banks of river Ganga. And of them, the greatest sage was Shuka, who's actually the teacher, the preceptor of Bhagavata Purana. Now, and the king puts one question to the sage, Shuka. The question is, Atha prichami samsiddhim yoginam paramam gurum purusha seha yatkaryam mriyamanasya sarvada. The essence of the meaning, mriyamanasya sarvada yatkaryam. What should a dying man do? What should a person whom death is staring on his face do? Remember, it is a hypothetical question. This is applicable to everyone. Maybe after 100 years, after 95 years. But the question has the relevance, a universal relevance. How should we live in this world in a way that we can be proud of our own life? That's the essence of it. And in answer to this, Shuka, the great sage and philosopher, gives a long exposition. The essence of the exposition, the answer is, you practice karma yoga, jnana yoga, bhakti yoga. Either if you believe in God, go to the church or temple or anywhere, spend some time in our ordinary life situation, along with all our activities, maybe worker, factory, working in a factory, in a hospital, university, wherever it is. A few minutes every day, at least half an hour every week, we can spend some time for accumulating some spiritual bank balance. That's it. Now, when we do this, it's not that we are waiting for the dying, for the next reincarnation, not at all. What it means is, it has got a profound implication in our own life. The idea that we will not be in this world after 100 years, which is a fact which everyone knows. Even the healthiest man can only hope for 100 years maybe. So after that we won't be here. Once we remember this and once we convert or translate this conviction into spiritual common sense and intellectual emotional maturity, an ability to pursue our life and interpret our life and actions from a higher perspective, it will make us more mature. It will have a leveling effect, a refining, it will have a spiritualizing effect in our life and activities. When even a businessman working hard to generate wealth, he can be a trillionaire if he wants. No problem. But he should remember the trillions of dollars he will one day leave him, or he will leave that huge wealth. This everyone knows. We all know, everyone knows. But this knowledge is only it is hiding within our system. It doesn't become a potent tool in our hands. It becomes a potent tool in our hands, a useful tool in our hands, only when it becomes a kind of spiritual common sense, a kind of spiritual level-headedness, so to speak. That's all. That will help us to as a guiding light in our life and activities. So this is about Parikshit. Now, Bhagavad Gita says, when you do something good, when you do something noble, when you accumulate something, what happens next life? We already discussed in the earlier sessions. The one verse is, Prapya punya kridan logan ushitva shashwati samaha suchinam simatam gehi yoga bhrashto bhijayati. There are two levels of evolution mentioned in the coming verse. Athava yogina ameva kule bhavati dhimatam edadhi durlabhadaram loki janma yadi drisham. This is the 41st and 42nd verses of the 6th chapter of the Gita. But it says, those who have done a lot of spiritual practices or some spiritual disciplines, we remember spiritual discipline doesn't necessarily mean meditation or prayer alone. A noble, unselfish activity for the good of others is a spiritual discipline. In fact, surprisingly, astonishingly, Gita doesn't even insist on believing in the reality of God to be as a necessary condition to be spiritual. That is the most astonishing, revolutionary concept coming from the Gita. I don't think, unfortunately, so to speak, our great men like Christopher Hitchens, who has passed away, Richard Dawkins, all these great, these are humanists, of course, in their own terms, at least, they may not be aware of this, these great teachings. Gita doesn't tell you to, it doesn't insist on your belief in a creator God or any kind of formal worship. What it tells you is, be a good human being. That's the essence of spirituality. Temples, churches, synagogues, prayers, meditation, all these are established useful tools for this purpose of becoming good human beings. So, any kind of noble activity, unselfishness, purity of thought and actions, broad-mindedness, kindness, all these qualities which we normally associate with spiritual persons, if we can have all these, we end up being spiritual human beings. So, if we can, now remember, prayer and meditation will help us in understanding, well, you know, mind becomes calm and quiet. At that time, we'll be able to take a very mature way of life as a whole, humanity as a whole, and that will help us to be more compassionate, understanding in our interactions with others. Suppose you have done only very little of these spiritual disciplines, but you feel you have still not reached your highest spiritual enlightenment. Gita says, don't worry, nothing is lost. And much more profound message, you are never late. Because you are moving along this cycle of birth, life, death, rebirth. So where does this wheel? The wheel has no end. Every point is beginning, middle and end of the wheel, rotating cycle. It's not like, not a straight line progression. Cyclicism, it is cyclic rotation. So you are never late, nothing is lost. So one can start his or her spiritual life any day, any moment. It doesn't mean that we should be complacent or we should go on procrastinating, not at all. In fact, the realization that nothing is going to be lost will make us aware we didn't spend our time properly. Surprisingly, you find the mystery, the mysterious thing that we frequently associate with many billionaire industrialists, who may have made pile up their money, not always necessarily through proper means, at some point they feel like loosening their purse. They're doing something good for others. That's because their own mind is telling them, do something, otherwise I'm not going to be peaceful. You're not able to get sleep. Suddenly you start a charity trust. Something you start doing. I know many Americans go to backward regions in different parts of the world, start projects for spreading education, literacy, many such things from all over the world you find. You know, why do they do that? Not always with the purpose of building up spiritual bank balance. No. Their mind tells them, if you want peace of mind, do this. Otherwise, no hope for you. They're forced to do that. But whether you're forced or not, the effect is the same. So what happens is, people who have done some spiritual disciplines, see lot of desires, lot of ambitions, still left unfulfilled. They call yoga bhrashta. I mean, those who have not fully reached the goal, I mean, they are away from the highest emancipation, highest spiritual enlightenment. What happens? They'd be born in a family where they can still enjoy a lot of wealth, but they will get a promotion, a great leap forward, not Chairman Mao's great leap forward, a great leap forward in the spiritual sense, remember, a great leap forward in the spiritual sense, a great promotion in our life. So they'll be born in family. That's why, you know, prapya punyakritan logan ushitva shashvati samaha suchinam simadam gehe yoga brishto vijayate. They'll be born in affluent families because they have a lot of money in this life, but they have done a lot of charity also. So there are a lot of ambitions still left out. So their ambition will be fulfilled in the next life. They'll be born in circumstances where they can continue the spiritual journey. And again, after several such life cycles, again, when they reach a point, they have no more desire. They become highly qualified spiritual seekers. They'll be born in families where the parents, the relatives, the circumstances also will be conducive to practicing the highest spiritual disciplines. That's why, you know, said, athava yoginameva kule bhavati dhimatam. Otherwise, those who are highly evolved, those who have done a lot of spiritual disciplines, their life, lot of renunciation, lot of great things, but still, they have not fully reached the level of a Buddha. What happens? They'll be born in families where they naturally they will practice asceticism, austerity, spiritual disciplines, and they will reach their goal. So here, of course, this, you know, these are ancient Sanskrit verses. It's not like a medical prescription. You do this and you get that. We should not interpret in that way. It's a great poetry. It's a great poetical outpouring of great spiritual truths. So we have to, there are a lot of metaphor, allegories and imaginations you can find. So the point is, our actions, our thoughts, our ideas, what we do can also help us in our spiritual evolution. Sometimes there could be mistakes. There could be, we may slip away from our goal. Still, nothing will be lost. I can narrate another very interesting episode from the same classic. There is also the story of a great king. Because we know why we are taking the stories of kings only. How kings became ascetics. How kings became all renouncing mendicants going about looking for alms. So that should be a fascinating story. The story Jadabharata. That Jadabharata Vakhyanam is called Bhagavata Purana. Interestingly, again a great king, he became very old. He must have become a grandfather, because in ancient Vedic tradition there's an interesting practice and tradition that when a householder becomes very old, he is sure that his family lineage will be continued, will be taken care of, his relations all are taken care of properly, then he and his wife should retire to some solemn place and spend their time either in teaching higher spiritual ideas or in contemplation or meditation. Let us say in modern times, doing something good for others, so to speak, when they don't have to struggle for their own livelihood, everything is okay, then they should do something for the good of others, for the good of humanity, kind of unselfish activity. So Jadabharata was a great emperor. Actually, he's the emperor of India. There are two stories. According to some historians, Dushyanta's son, Bharata, from that king, India got the old name Bharatavarsha. Bharata is the old traditional name of India. According to another source, the Jadabharata, and Jadabharata actually means, Bharata was the name of the king. Jada means he became as good as dead, inactive. So from him, India got the ancient name Bharata. So Bharata is the real name of India. You know, you can find in Indian flag or passport, you can find. So this is a story. So this king was a man of great wisdom. When he became too old, he left his kingdom, he made his eldest son the next heir apparent, and he went to a holy place on the banks of the river, and then there he just built a small tiny hut and stayed, taking bath every day in the river, reading scriptures and meditating, puja, like that he lived for many years. So one day it so happened that he heard a terrible noise outside, and he found a deer, a female deer, was being chased by a lion, and it crossed across the tiny stream, and as it crossed, it was pregnant, it gave birth to a baby deer, and in the effort it died. So the little baby deer was floating the stream. So the king got compassion and he plunged in the river and saved the baby deer. And this deer, little one, it began growing up in the hermitage. This is the story unfolds. So this is, first he was a great king, then he became a hermit, and then he became so compassionate and he started growing, looking after this deer. He became very much attached to the little animal because a tiny creature. It will be devoured by wild animals, so he took great precaution to protect it from wild animals. What happened, you know, by the time he had become very old, it was time for him to die. At that time, what happened? He slowly stopped meditation, daily meditation. He stopped reading holy books. He stopped contemplating on higher thoughts. His whole time and energy and time were devoted to taking care of the baby deer. Because it was so tiny, so it needed food, grass and leaves and things like that, and also protection from wild animals. So what happened, you know, he knew that he should do all this, but he should not take his mind away from God. Instead of that, you know what happened? Slowly his mind got completely immersed in his duty, as he considered himself to be responsible for that duty, for performing that duty of taking care of this baby deer. And it was time for him to die. And he was supposed to think of God. Instead, he was thinking of this baby deer, this little animal. So what happened? By the time came for him to die. So remember, a great king, a great emperor, who had left his own palace, left his own children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all the luxuries, came to the holy river, built a tiny hut, a hermitage, where he lived, where he meditated and did pray and did all his spiritual disciplines. Slowly thought he was the only custodian of the animal, the baby deer. Now, he knew that he should have done this duty. It's an act of compassion. You know, compassion, kind-heartedness, kindness to animals is part of spiritual culture, an integral, inseparable part of spiritual culture. But it should not replace his meditation. So he stopped meditation, stopped prayer. His only job was to take care of the deer. So he died not thinking of God, but thinking of the deer. So what happened? When he was born again, he was born as a deer. The great king, man of great renunciation, became a great ascetic, then was born as a deer. But does it mean that the great spiritual practices and wisdom and spirituality disciplines, all these he practiced, will go in vain? Not at all. But this deer had one peculiarity. Jatabharata born as a deer, that deer lived the same hermitage. It won't go away from there. It will never leave the place. It will not mix with any other deers. It will only live in that near the hermit, moving around, eating the leaves and grass around baby in hermitage. And it may have lived for some years. It died. And it was born as the son of a great sage. So he was the youngest son, but he still remembered the terrible wrong association he had in the past. He was a philosopher, king, a wise man, who renounced everything, became an ascetic. And then, what happened, you know, he was again obsessed with taking care of an animal. And then what happened? Because of that, he lost interest in his own spiritual disciplines. And he had to be born as a deer. And that deer died. He was born as a son of a wise man. But he remembered. So what happened? He would keep quiet. He won't speak to anyone. He won't associate with anyone. He will have nothing to do with this world. So he lived like that. So his brother, after his father's death, his brothers drew him away. Worthless fellow. So he's good for nothing. Drew him away. And he wandered about. So one day he was wandering about. At that time, another king, he called Rahugana, he was coming in a palanquin. And he, one of the palanquin, maybe people used to bear, they used to take kings and aristocrats in a palanquin and take. So one of the palanquin bearers became very tired and sick. So he could not do that. They were looking for some strong, healthy person to replace. And they suddenly found this man, who was a king earlier. He was a deer, but he won't speak one word because he remembered all his previous life cycles. So he won't mix with this world any longer. He wanted to be always immersed in the higher contemplation. So he pretended to be a dull wheat, so to speak. Dunce and dull. He won't talk to anyone. But one day, as a man, they consider him as a good replacement, and he began to bear this palanquin. But he was not trained in that work. So there was a lot of jolt and disturbance. The king got terribly disturbed. He got angry. He stopped. He asked this man, "Why are you bearing this palanquin in this unstable manner? It creates a lot of problems, disturbance." Then he said, "Who is bearing whom? You are this body. I am also this body. This body, your body, and my body, they are all made of the five elements. And you knew within this body, there is that eternal Atman. The same Atman is within me. So who is bearing whom?" And this king suddenly came to him as a great surprise. It's a shock. There's a long dialogue between this Jadabharata. He was called Jadabharata. Bharata was his name. Jada means he was so dull, inactive. So this king and this palanquin bearer, who was Jadabharata, the great king in previous life, then born as a deer and so on, the long dialogue, one of the most profound spiritual dialogues in the entire classic. So what happens? Of course, we are not concerned with that right now in this present context. What it means is, this king had a deviation, a yoga prastavijaya. He had a deviation because he had renounced everything and became an ascetic. Then he had a deviation from his own ascetic practices. He should have taken care of the deer, but he should have practiced a lot of detachment. When we practice compassion, kindness, we should do everything possible, but we should not ever imagine, "I am going to be compassionate. I am the sole protector of everyone around. I am the one who is taking care of those whom I am taking care of. If you have this problem, it creates a lot of bondages. It creates a bondage. It becomes a chain that binds us. So the highest of virtues should be practiced with all sincerity. At the same time, a degree of detachment is necessary. In modern times, the detachment is necessary for our own peace of mind and also for our spiritual progress. So whatever we do will not be lost. That's what the story shows. Because the king had to be born as a deer, but the deer retained in its mind all the great spiritual disciplines it had practiced as a great king in his previous life. That's why it did not leave the hermitage. Again, when the deer died, deer was thinking of Brahman, Atman, God. He was immersed in divine meditation. That's why when he was reborn, he was born as the sun, but he was already enlightened. So, from the king to the deer, and the deer to the enlightened person. What it means? There is a gradual evolution. So remember, the law of karma and reincarnation can be a very refining philosophy of ethics and morality. It can make us think for a moment, well, I am doing something, but what will happen to me because of this? It doesn't mean that we should become timid or inactive or all the time suspecting and worrying. Not at all. If it becomes a part of our emotional system, it can make us more level-headed, more balanced, and more mature in our thoughts, our activities. It becomes a refining, a spiritually refining guide and a teacher and a pathfinder in our life. So we'll continue this discussion again from another perspective. There are many dimensions to this doctrine of law of karma and reincarnation. It is easy to say something based on some case story, case studies. There are many books written on this subject. You know, suddenly a little child started thinking, started saying that his relatives are there somewhere in Ireland. So the child is taken from US to Ireland, and there he is taken to a tiny village, unknown village, and the child enters the home, and he suddenly recognizes all the rooms, and he addresses maybe a 50-year-old, 60-year-old person as my son, you know. So stories are there. These are all certain, these are things which are very interesting. But there is a spiritual philosophy and ethical philosophy behind it. The law of karma and reincarnation can be a very profound and very effective way of looking at our life as a whole. And also it can make us desist from doing something which is obviously wrong. Instead of giving full freedom to our mind and senses, do whatever you want, and finally you can get a waiver. That doesn't work. God is not a fool that he forgives everything, knowing about doing everything that we want. Finally, you God excuse me. If you say, okay, fine. We cannot say that. We cannot do that. Rather, belief in God is something that we spread thin or entire life. That's the idea. It's not just a confession on one fine morning. Actually, according to Augustine's interpretation of confession, you know, every sincere confession is a spiritual transformation. If you read The City of God and his own book, Confessions, in English translation, you find. True confession is really the beginning of a new life. It's not a licensed renewal program. It is the beginning of a new life. It is not a license for us to do whatever we want, finally say excuse me, sir, to God. Not at all. Rather, It is a spiritual transformation. So many of the great saints they became saints because they confessed in the true sense of the term in which Augustine interpreted confession in his own classical work. So that's in a way agrees with the ideas that you find in Vedantic scriptures, where anyone can just one day, one split second, can become a different person. But for that, our mind should allow us to do what we want. For that, there should be previous samskaras. So, if from a Hindu perspective, St. Paul, St. Francis of Assisi, even St. Augustine himself, who had a different lifestyle before they became saints, they have already done a lot of spiritual disciplines in the past. Then there was an interim period. And suddenly when something happened, it brought them back to their own previous memories. So this transformation took place. Spiritual transformation cannot happen in a vacuum. It happens against the background. So the great saints that you read about who had sudden transformations, it is not just a sudden transformation, really speaking. From a rational angle, from a Vedantic perspective, they had this background. They may have done a lot of spiritual disciplines in the past, then an interim period, some kind of what you call yoga brashtobijaya, some deviation. When suddenly they could recollect their own past, they became saints and sages. So that's the story, just like, you know, the deer never forgot its own past. Born again, it remembered his previous life, living as a great king and ascetic and spiritual practitioner. But then, when you go to a library, read a great book, suddenly you feel this beginning of a new, you feel at home in a place which you're visiting for the first time. You read a book and you feel, well, something revealing. It doesn't really happen in a vacuum. We have made our own background, we have made our own preparations, sometime, maybe not in this life, in previous life. You know, we are recollecting, unconsciously, we are reconnecting with our own wonderful things we have done in the past. That's why we feel a great attraction to spiritual ideas when we read a book for the time. For the first time, Paul Brandon going to Chennai and suddenly going to Ramana Maharshi, then he goes to Calcutta, he meets M. Mahendranath Gupta, and they walk together, you can find in Dakshinesha. So we had long conversation. You can just read about Paul Brandon's first meeting, Yam, the chronicler, the writer of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And he waits outside in that upper story of the building. And then after some time, Yam enters the room. And then Paul Brandon talks to him. And there are two things that he says. First, he admires Yam's proper pronunciation, accent. Second, he compares Yam to some great Hebrew prophet coming out of the pages of the Old Testament. Two imageries you can find in Paul Brandon's responses when he responds when suddenly Yam enters the room where he was waiting for him. So you can imagine, how did that happen? Paul Brandon must have prepared his own background, his own ground for it. That's why suddenly when he read something, immediately the seeds sprouted because the soil was fertile. That's how it works. So I was trying to give a rather scriptural interpretation of the whole dynamics of law, karma and rebirth. And I think we'll continue discussion in the coming session. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tatsat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.